Otzi, but it's...
I'd like to call the meeting to order. It's Thursday, April 10th, 2014. This is the Committee on Health, Human Services, and Housing. And Chair Sharon is in finance presenting a bill this morning, so we will begin. And Senator Dibble, to your bill, the Senate file 1641, medical marijuana use authorization.
Great. Thank you, Chair Wicklund and members, and my apologies for the tardy start. I was just up in finance myself presenting an unsession bill, which ended up having a lot of questions that I had to respond to. Plus, no one showed up on time, so senators, you know. Madam Chair and members, I bring you Senate File 1641 because literally thousands of Minnesotans on this very day are living with symptoms of illnesses and disorders that cause a tremendous amount of discomfort and pain, and existing therapies are failing them. In some cases, even creating a whole host of other issues, side effects, addiction, and sometimes even worse. In the meantime, they're being denied safe access, legal access, reliable access to a substance, cannabis, that can, in many instances, as shown through some research and experience, to help alleviate some of those issues to a greater or lesser degree. It's shown to be relatively safe, can't overdose, addiction rates do occur, but in some instances far less than what's available to them through traditional pharmaceuticals and traditional prescriptions. So, Madam Chair, members, we're asking to allow Minnesotans the freedom that citizens of 20 other states and the District of Columbia now have, and we're asking in the name of compassion to have access to something that could make a real difference for the better in their lives. The alternative is that they go without, continue to endure the only treatments that are available to them through pharmaceuticals, or operate outside of the law at great personal risk, and in so doing support a criminal system and the corruption and violence that goes with that. So, Madam Chair and members, the key, of course, is to make sure that they can have access to medical cannabis with sufficient safeguards so as to prevent what have been raised as concerns that we all share. So in support of those goals, I'm just going to go, Madam Chair, if you don't mind, at a very high level over the proposal. I'm not going to go into detail on the bill itself until after we have the testimony, and then we'll walk through what the specific provisions, but I want to touch on the highlights, go to testimony, and then return to the detailed presentation of the bill and respond to questions.
Senator Dibble, do you want to adopt the delete everything amendment?
Oh, yes. Madam Chair, why don't we do that? I'll move the A3 amendment, Madam.
Senator Dibble offers the A3 author's amendment. This is a delete everything amendment. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes.
So, very quickly, the A3 amendment, I'll just, in very, very high level, describe that it makes sure that medical cannabis is limited to be prescribed only for certain conditions, only by certain licensed healthcare professionals through a very traditional patient-provider relationship and a thorough assessment of their health condition, that there be strong registration requirements of patients and caregivers, that we limit where and how there is access through alternative treatment centers, otherwise previously known as dispensaries, that are subject to a high level of scrutiny and any other prudent measures that the regulating agency deems necessary. Sensible restrictions and conditions on where and how medical cannabis can be used, and strong penalties for any misuse or violation of the rules. It would be, I think, while we're listening to testimony at the convenience of the members, just to glance at this handout, which is in your packet, titled A Comparison Between Minnesota's Medical Marijuana Bill, California's, and New Mexico's, because we know, at least in one instance, California has done a poor job. New Mexico has done a really excellent job. The Minnesota bill touches on those number of provisions that are in this proposal in front of you and how we respond, I think, even to a better and greater degree than even New Mexico has.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dibble, could you explain the differences between Senate File 1641 and the A3 Amendment, please?
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Rosen, I'll have Heather Uzzi help me as well. Probably one of the biggest changes is that the ability to cultivate marijuana privately has been eliminated, so there's no homegrown. Probably one of the biggest changes. What are some of the other?
A couple of the other major changes, members.
And please, can I have you introduce yourself for the record?
My name is Heather Uzzi. I am political director of Minnesotans for Compassionate Care.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, the other major differences in this bill are, besides the removal of home cultivation for the patient, the Commissioner of Health is given a little bit more power to create a program to track the marijuana plants from seed to sale to the patient. There's one more major.
We're trying to remember what the other major change is.
Madam Chair, if we could go through the amendment. This is a, delete all. It's quite large. If we could,
Chair,
could point out
like
some of the differences.
I'd like to get to the testimony, and then I'll go through the delete all in detail as soon as we're done.
Senator Rosen, will that work? Can we do it in that order?
Actually, I kind of want to know the difference between this A3 amendment. This is a major change.
Senator Dibble, can you switch the order and go through the amendment?
As you wish, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, like I said before, the purposes for which someone can qualify for use is limited to a certain number of qualifying conditions, that's found in Subdivision 7. Debilitating medical conditions, and you can see that a number of conditions are listed there starting at the top of page 2. We have fairly strong prescribing standards, although the language used is recommendation. Via written certification process, you can see that in Subdivision 19, a document signed and dated by a licensed practitioner who has to...
Excuse me, Senator Dibble, just a moment. Senator Nelson,
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Dibble, it's hard to find where you are in the bill, so could you kindly, as you talk about it, reference for us where you are in this delete-all amendment?
Yeah.
Page, line,
yes,
number.
Absolutely. Thank you, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Senator Dibble.
So in those instances when someone is prescribed or has received the recommendation for use of medical cannabis, you can find that on 3.23, some of the standards of the thresholds that have to be met. Subdivision 19 written certification, there has to be a recognized need and a full examination. Only certain types of licensed professionals can authorize, have this authority. That's page 2.26, practitioner, the definition of practitioners, doctors of osteopathy, APRNs, doctors, et cetera. And there's a limitation, Madam Chair, of course, only to certain people, as I mentioned before, those with a debilitating medical condition, again, that refers back to Subdivision 7. There's a fairly strong regimen of controls over when those folks do qualify for use of medical cannabis through a registration card with strong security standards and features and very strong verification technology, et cetera. You have to give me a moment to find where we
Senator
have
Dibble,
those provisions.
Moment. Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you. I think Senator Dibble is looking for it. I'm looking for the reference, Senator
right.
Dibble. Thank you.
Senator
Dibble.
That would be in Section 6, page 7, registry identification cards. And so you have a whole list of standards of how folks can qualify for those registry identification cards, which I think is a very strong provision for controlling who has access and the like. Likewise, along those same lines, the amount that anyone can have is controlled to 2.5 ounces. And that, I think, is under, back in the definitions, the allowable amount of cannabis, that's line 1.11, 2.5 ounces of usable cannabis. Usable refers to, of course, the parts that can be used, not the parts that can't be used, like the seeds and stems and things like that. Along those same lines, Madam Chair, there are pretty strict penalties for the misuse. When folks, so if you look under violations, section 17, that's on page 18 and 19, if a cardholder has diverted, is the term, their cannabis, their marijuana, they already have a number of penalties, of course, that exist under the law, but in addition, they are guilty of a penalty and or a fine of $3,000. Plus, if they attempt to receive a card for false reasons and use medical cannabis for false reasons, there are a number of provisions throughout this whole violations section that provide some fairly significant sanctions. There are strong limits and controls on the alternative treatment centers, what have been previously known as dispensaries, subject to, first of all, it's important to take a note of the rulemaking authority that the commissioner has. That's on section 4. So the commissioner has a lot of authority to set all kinds of security and control standards, et cetera, and you can read through that at your leisure. But background checks, business plans, making sure that there are strong standards in consultation with law enforcement personnel, making sure that the facilities themselves are very safe and very secure. Likewise, we allow local units of government to enact reasonable land use and zoning standards, and I can find that for you. That's on page 11, section 9. So zoning rules, of course, cover location, signage, those sorts of things. I believe there's a standard, and I'm not sure where it is, that sensitive uses need to be at least 1,000 feet away from these facilities, things like schools and the like. There are a limited number of facilities, and that's controlled by the population of a given county. So, a county like Hennepin that has over 1 million people in it can have up to three, and then it steps down to 2. I can't remember the details, and I can find that for you.
Yes, it's in section 6.
That's section 6, which is on. Wait a minute. Sure.
It would be in section 5. I'm sorry.
Sorry, section 5. Kind of in the middle of the page there. Starting on paragraph 4, 6.17. The much smaller counties would have none. Counties between 20 and 300 can have one, and 300 to 1 million can have 2, and above 1 million can have 3. So that's a pretty strong limitation on the number of facilities that there will be throughout the state. That is, I think, a pretty high-level overview. Is there anything I've missed?
We're in that.
Okay. Other parts of the bill, Madam Chair and members, provide for the legal protections and the circumstances in which people, including professionals who support them, have what their legal rights look like and the construction of law around those issues. We provide for the establishment of fees and the deposit of fees. That's in Section 19. And the fees shall be sufficient to support all of the public services and all the public support that there needs to be around governing and regulating and overseeing this particular program. There's an advisory council established in Section 20 that the Commissioner of Health shall establish to guide and make recommendations so that there's consultation with the appropriate stakeholders and professionals for the purposes of reviewing petitions, if other medical conditions need be added in the future, the rules that the commissioner shall adopt, rules around alternative treatment centers and their adequacy, other recommendations around regulatory and security safeguards, and paying attention to the best practices that are going on in other states. Some minor items. We make sure that this is comfort language. This is Section 21 on page 21, the drug formulary. We make sure that cannabis will not be placed on the drug formulary. And I think that, Madam Chair, is a extent of my high-level overview. One more item I was going to add that the professional boards, particularly the Board of Medical Practice, is given the authority to make sure that practitioners, providers, are doing as what's required of them in this law, so that they're doing the full assessment of patients and their conditions, the full evaluation as they determine whether or not that person should be allowed access to medical cannabis.
Thank you, Senator Dibble. Did you want to proceed with your testifiers at this point?
If that's your wish, yes, that would be.
Sure. I had information that Dr. Jacob Merman would like to be the first testifier because of scheduling commitments. So if
and Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Then we'll be able to ask questions about the changes in the bill after testifying.
Yes, Senator Rosen,
thank you.
Definitely. Thank you, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Hello, Madam Chair. I'm Jacob Merman, MD. I'm a medical director of Life Medical, which is an integrative primary care clinic in St. Louis Park. I'm a specialist in primary care internal medicine and some integrative modalities. Should just go ahead with
yes, please proceed with your testimony.
First, I'd like to introduce how our clinic works. The patients come to me because they need help. My job is to help them in the most efficient and least harmful way possible. The buck stops with me. That means if I send a patient to a specialist and the specialist is unable to help, the patient comes back to me and their medical care is again my responsibility. When a standard approaches don't help, my responsibility as the physician does not end. I have to become creative and look outside of the standard practices. I have to continue learning and looking for new methodologies. In our integrative clinic, we have done just that and added a number of modalities, including physical therapy, psychology, homeopathy, acupuncture, naturopathic medicine, herbal medicine, and some other modalities, all done by qualified practitioners. And this enables us to help a lot more patients than we could have done with conventional care alone, although conventional care is still the backbone of the clinic. I see medical marijuana as one more potential complementary therapy. We can help a vast majority of our patients with other methods, but for some, marijuana may be the only thing that works, and I'd like to be able to refer a patient that needs it to an appropriate specialist who can prescribe it. Not planning on doing it myself in the clinic. So I'd like to give you a little idea of what kind of cases I see. A couple years ago, I had a case. This was a woman with end-stage breast cancer on chemotherapy, suffering with intractable nausea. And she has been given all the conventional medications by her oncologist. They didn't help, and so she actually resorted to getting illegal marijuana somewhere. I don't know where. So when she told me, was I supposed to tell her, no, don't do it, it's illegal? I think that would be unethical, because that's the only thing that helped her. So I just said, okay, well, you do what you have to do. Unfortunately, she is no longer with us, this patient. I do have a current patient right now who has multiple sclerosis. And in that case, the gentleman is very disabled. He has a lot of spasticity in the muscles. Also on all the conventional medications, which are not helpful to him. He is seeing all the specialists that are, you know, they usually handle this condition. So he also found that smoking marijuana actually helps him, and that's what he is doing. So again, he's telling me this. Am I supposed to tell him no? You know, this is illegal. Last time he asked me, Doc, can you get me a card so I don't need to buy it illegally on the street? I said, well, we're working on it, but it's not there yet. So I would like to help these people by doing it legally. I have another case right now who is a 90-year-old Russian gentleman. His wife died last year. He is still very depressed. He has a lot of different issues, including physical and emotional issues. He has a lot of nausea, and he can't eat anything. He doesn't have any appetite. He's losing weight. So he has seen the gastroenterologist. They didn't find anything. He is seeing a psychiatrist. He is on all the right antidepressants. They are not doing it. So I have started a couple of weeks ago another complementary therapy. We hope it works. But if it doesn't, I don't see anything else for him but smoking marijuana or using some other method of, vaporizer or whatever. But I can't tell him that because it's illegal. On the other hand, if I don't tell him that, it's unethical on my part to withhold this information. So you see, I'm in a bind here. And you have to unbind me so I can do what's ethical for my patients. So there's certain pros and cons for allowing medical marijuana in, for use by doctors. Let me list a couple. First of all, obviously, it's known, it has been shown to help in certain conditions, such as nausea, loss of appetite, seizures, spasticity, glaucoma, some forms of pain, and some other conditions. For some of them, it helps better than other medications. It is somewhat addictive, but less so than other medications we commonly use, such as opioids, benzodiazepines, etc. Definitely less addictive than the stuff you can buy in the store, like alcohol and cigarettes. It is really one of the safest drugs out there. It may sound counterintuitive, but let's compare to things like Tylenol, for example. Tylenol is a very dangerous drug. People commit suicide with it. People suffer liver failures from using it normally. And yet it's on the shelf over the counter in the pharmacy. Ibuprofen. People die every year from using ibuprofen, from GI bleeds, from heart attacks, well-known facts. Prozac induces suicides. Many drugs out there are much more dangerous than marijuana. Definitely opioids, which we all know about. People don't die from marijuana. There's really no overdose for this drug. So my question is, why can't I be trusted to recommend a drug that is safe like this rather than something that's much more dangerous? And obviously, what about alcohol and tobacco that kill so many people all the time, and they are out in the open market. It's completely unreasonable to restrict something that's so safe and allow something that's much more dangerous. There are certain cons that are brought up. One, that this is inhaled smoke. It's not good for you. It's harmful to your lungs. Well, number one, there is some research indicating that for some reason this smoke doesn't harm as much as tobacco smoke. We don't quite know the reasons, but there are some immunoactive components in the drug that protect against cancer, possibly. So maybe that's why it's not as harmful. And besides, vaporizers are available for use, and that avoids the smoke issue. So not a good con. It's mind-altering drug. Well, there's so many others out there. We're using them all the time, opioids, benzodiazepines, et cetera. Not a good argument. Making medical marijuana legal will increase its use in kids. Well, I've seen some studies where it indicates that it's not borne by evidence. This really doesn't happen in the states where this is done. People are going to drive under the influence of marijuana. Well, there's laws for this already, so I don't, we can continue using the same laws for this substance as well. There's abuse potential for the drug, definitely, and people will be abusing it. But then there's other drugs that are being abused as well, and there are already safeguards for those drugs, so I don't see that adding another one like this will cause any trouble. Besides, it's less addictive than most of the others. There's not enough research. It is true, there is not enough research. We need more research. However, research is very difficult to do when this is a Schedule I substance, and it's very difficult to do research on a Schedule I substance. So it really needs to be rescheduled to get more research. So we are in a Catch-22 here. We need to do something about it. And then there's an interesting argument. This is not a clean drug. The plant has many active components. It's hard to know what works in it. Again, it's true. However, we have been using medications like this for thousands of years. All the herbal medications are like this. They have many different components in them, and we have a lot of experience in using them. So there is really no reason to not allow this drug because of that. And a lot of people feel that this is how nature intended, and the medications work better when they're balanced in this way. At least that's what my herbalist friend is telling me. So in my professional opinion, the law prohibiting the use of marijuana for medical purposes makes no sense. It needs to be changed so doctors can use this medicine if they believe it is for the best of their patients. And I think it's just a matter of common sense. That's all I have to say right now. I can take any questions.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Merman. Are there any questions for the testifier? So thank you for that. Let's see. One thing I forgot to mention at the beginning of the meeting, we did have a quorum present when we first began the meeting, when Senator Dibble began. Next, do you want to have a couple of witnesses come up at a time? We have Angie Weaver and Jessica Hauser. Oh, okay. Yeah,
oh, okay.
Here, why don't I clear out?
Welcome, and thank you for joining us. And please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Committee. I'd like to introduce myself. I'm Angie Weaver. This is my daughter, Amelia. She's 7 years old. My husband, Josh, and my 3-year-old daughter, Penelope. Do you want to say hi?
No? Probably not.
It's very hard to bring my whole family here today, but this is so important to us that I thought you should all see my family and what we're here fighting for and what the families and patients need so much. My name is Angie Weaver. I am a stay-at-home mom from Hibbing, Minnesota. I earned my bachelor's degree in family consumer science from Minnesota State University, Mankato. Before I had my daughters, I worked in a variety of settings, including daycares and elementary school, and for Lutheran Social Services. I've always loved children and could not wait to have my own. My husband, who works for the state of Minnesota in information technology at Hibbing Community College, and I have been married for 11 years. We have two daughters, Amelia, age 7, and Penelope, age 3. I would like to tell you a little bit about my daughter, Amelia. Amelia was born a beautiful, healthy baby girl on May 2, 2006. She was more beautiful than I ever could have imagined. She filled our lives with so much fun, joy, and excitement those first 2 years. It's always hard to put into words how much you love your child, but I can try. Being Amelia's mother and Penelope's has brought me the greatest joy and most overwhelming feeling of love I have ever felt in my life. Amelia hit all her developmental milestones until she turned 18 months old. At 18 months old, she caught the flu and had a seizure in our pediatrician's office. Watching my baby have a seizure was the scariest moment of my life. Time seems to stand still, yet stretch on forever. You forget to breathe. You hear the pounding of your heart. This is an experience I wish no parent ever had to have. Our pediatrician told us the seizure was likely a febrile seizure caused by her fever and flu bug, and to take extra care when she had fevers. I was so scared it could happen again, but she seemed to be doing okay. Amelia did not have another seizure for an entire year. When she was 2 and a half, she was walking, talking in sentences, singing her alphabet, and counting to 20. She loved to be read to. She even memorized the words to Clifford the Big Red Dog and would read them to us like a big girl. We woke up late one morning when Amelia was 2 and a half. She usually wakes up first, so it was strange that she was sleeping later than us. My husband went to check on her and found Amelia having a seizure in her crib. We do not know how long she'd been having her seizure for. By the time we got to the hospital, that seizure had stopped and another had started. Amelia went on to have 4 more seizures before they sedated her to the point that she stopped seizing. I vividly remember standing over her hospital bed, watching her face turn blue and her entire body shake with a seizure. She was so tiny in the hospital bed in her little yellow footy pajamas. I prayed and prayed that her seizures would stop. The next 4 months were spent in and out of 3 different hospitals, searching for relief that we couldn't find. We could not find anything to help control the seizures, and Amelia lost the ability to talk, walk, and feed herself. To go from one day having your child singing the ABCs in the bathtub to the next, her not being able to get out of the hospital bed is an indescribable agony. After 4 months, with a combination of a special diet and 2 anticonvulsant medications, Amelia was able to have a short period of being seizure-free. She gained back the ability to walk and talk. I resigned myself to the fact that she would suffer from seizures, but I believe that we had more control over the situation. I thought she'd be able to talk and have a full life. I felt like we could handle this as a family. Unfortunately, this period of seizure control did not last. Since then, Amelia has been on over 23 anticonvulsant medications. We've tried every medicine that is out there for Amelia. The side effects from these anticonvulsants have caused Amelia brittle bones, liver damage. She suffered from side effects like a severe allergic reaction, nausea, vomiting, sleeplessness, just to name a few. I mean, I could sit here for hours and tell you the side effects from these medications. It has taken her quality of life. Currently, Amelia is having over 30 or more seizures a day. Yesterday, she had such a rough day that today she won't even be able to stay awake, and she'll still, when she is awake, be having seizures. She has to be strapped into a chair even though she can walk because she cannot safely go anywhere without having a seizure. She's lost the ability to speak since age 4 completely. She has regressed developmentally, and she is now globally delayed. I have to stay home at full time to provide Amelia the care she needs. We had tests done at 4 different hospitals to see why Amelia was having her seizures. At age 6, the Mayo Clinic genetically diagnosed Amelia with Dravet syndrome. Dravet syndrome is a rare, catastrophic form of epilepsy. This is a very hard diagnosis to get. There is a startling shortage of treatment options, as anticonvulsant medications rarely work. And the long-term outcome of kids with Dravet syndrome is not good. We'd already tried the special diet and 23 anticonvulsant medications. They were not working. The kind of people that my husband and I are people that refuse to believe that this is going to be our daughter's life. We immediately started researching what other parents of children with Dravet syndrome are doing. We are amazed to hear all the reports of success of parents treating their children with Dravet syndrome with a specific form of medicinal cannabis. This specific form of medicinal cannabis has high levels of CBD, which do not induce the same psychoactive and physiological effects often associated with marijuana. The CBD is extracted and mixed with an oil to be administered with a dropper orally, just like her other medications. Children using this medicine have regained skills, cognitive function, and it's giving them seizure control. I cannot tell you what even having one seizure a day would mean to Amelia. She would have a life. Children like my daughter with Dravet syndrome that weren't talking are starting to speak again. If my daughter said mommy, daddy, sister, it would be the best day of our lives. I didn't want my daughter to suffer one more day. I wanted to get her the medication that would help her. After further research, we concluded that the only way my daughter can have the medicine that she needs to control her seizures would either be to move to a state where medical cannabis is legal or to help change the law in our beloved home state of Minnesota. I will do anything for my daughter, including moving. But the thought of leaving our family, support system, community we grew up in, church, friends, and my husband's job and health insurance is so hard to think about. When you have a child with life-changing special needs, you need that support. We depend on our families. Both of our parents live in Hibbing, and they help with Amelia and our daughter Penelope so much. Josh has a great job and awesome coworkers. Moving to another state far from our family and friends would be so hard on us. We want to stay in Minnesota. It's our home. I believe the people of Minnesota are compassionate enough and smart enough to put policies into place that allow people with debilitating conditions like my daughter to have access to the medicine they need. We are not criminals. We're law-abiding citizens. We are just parents that are asking for you to help our daughter.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming today and sharing your experience with us. Are there any questions, members, for Ms. Weaver? Thank you. Thank you again. Next on the list, I have Jessica Hauser and Patrick McClellan. Welcome, and please state your name for the record.
Thank you. Good morning, Madam Chair and committee members. My name is Jessica Hauser, and thank you for considering my testimony today. My name is Jessica Hauser. As I said, my husband, Jeremy Hauser, and I are both citizens of Minnesota, and we're asking for safe and legal access to medical marijuana for our little boy. If you ask me on the day our son Wyatt was born, if I supported medical marijuana, I would have said yes, of course, for those who need it, not knowing that in the coming year, my son would be one of those who needed it, and I would become a passionate advocate for medical marijuana to give to my sweet baby boy. When our son was 7 months old, he was diagnosed with a rare and very difficult to treat form of epilepsy called infantile spasms. Despite its name, it's not something he is likely to outgrow, and it is incredibly devastating. He suffers nearly 100 seizures every day. He's already had 40 since we've been in this room. These seizures rob him of his cognitive development, his personality, and his overall quality of life. If they continue, his future is at best uncertain. He is now almost 2 years old, and he's very far behind his peers developmentally. And we still don't know why he has these seizures. He has no other diagnosis. We are very blessed to live in Minnesota and work with some of the best doctors in the world. And under their guidance, we have been able to provide Wyatt with the best treatments and medical care currently available. Unfortunately, these treatments have done little to stop his seizures. He has tried and failed 10 medications, tried diet therapy, various vitamin and enzyme supplements, and had no success. Most of these treatments aren't without serious drawbacks themselves, many with side effects that are difficult for adults to tolerate, much less an infant. He's endured 7 weeks of steroid injections that my husband and I had to administer to him, a course of oral steroids at a dose that would be much better suited to an adult, and various anti-epileptic medications that sedate him, at the same time causing insomnia, affecting his coordination, making him very irritable and uncomfortable. And essentially, they cause him to live in an altered state. They so seriously affect his quality of life, it looks like he's intoxicated much of the time. He is currently on benzodiazepines, Valium-like drugs that do cause dependence and have a high potential for abuse. We must monitor these medications very closely. Stopping these meds could cause serious withdrawal symptoms, including more seizures that cannot be stopped, and hallucinations. However, if these worked, we would be tremendously grateful because they are being administered to Wyatt with compassion and care and through risk-benefit discussions with his doctor. However, they haven't worked, and we are literally running out of things to try. As we have been researching medical marijuana for our son, we learned it is helping children with epilepsy like his, resulting in greater seizure control and with minimal side effects due to the low toxicity of the medicine. We have met the parents who have shared these stories, and we've read countless stories. We have also spoken to researchers from a biotechnology firm in Oregon. They are using existing research to develop lab-tested marijuana-based medicines designed to treat specific symptoms, including seizures, by tapping into the potential of all the medicinal applications the plant has to offer. They use this research to help patients, physicians, and legislators in that state really understand the science of marijuana. Children in Colorado and Oregon and other states where medical marijuana is legal are receiving this treatment now, and they are seeing results now. Unfortunately, the current laws in Minnesota prohibit us from accessing this real and viable treatment option for our son. We love Minnesota. We love our family, friends, and our lives here. We have an amazing network of support, and we love our jobs. We respect and care about the physicians that treat Wyatt and want their guidance in all medicines that we administer to him. We don't want to move, but if this law doesn't pass, we will be forced to leave to give our son the chance to have a better life, a life that he deserves. We will need to go to a state where we can provide our son with the medicine that he needs, with new doctors, and without our current support system. It is not easy for anyone to move, and when you have a child with special needs and a complex medical situation, it is 1,000 times more challenging and heartbreaking. We hope that lawmakers also consider a recent call to action included in a statement by the National Epilepsy Foundation and support appropriate changes to state laws to increase access to medical marijuana as a treatment option for epilepsy, including pediatric use, as supported by a physician. With that, I am begging you, the lawmakers of this state, to make this medicine available to all the patients of Minnesota who need it, and who need it now, especially children like my son Wyatt. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, and thank you also for bringing your testimony today. Members, do you have any questions for Ms. Hauser? Thank you again for coming.
Thank you.
Next, we have Patrick McClellan.
Hello, my name is Patrick McClellan, and thank you very much for hearing me today. I have muscular dystrophy. Mitochondrial myopathy is the exact condition. I suffer from severe muscle spasms, peripheral neuropathy, and chronic pain. I also lost my career and became totally disabled about 4 years ago. I have found that eating or vaporizing cannabis has a remarkable effect on reducing my muscle spasms and pain. I'm treated at Gillette Specialty Healthcare, and my doctors are aware of my use of cannabis and have told me that many other patients are reporting the same result. I currently take 26 pills every day, a mix of muscle relaxants, anti-seizure medications, neuropathic painkillers, and along with a high-dose vitamin therapy. I also have braces on both legs that help me walk. One of the most intense and painful symptoms of my disease is severe muscle spasms. During an attack, I am unable to walk, to eat, to use the bathroom, or to dial 911. I do receive warning signs prior to an attack, fasciculations or twitches of the muscles that will start anywhere from an hour to 30 minutes prior to an attack. During the winter of 2010, I had an attack that left me trapped between my bed and the wall for over 2.5 hours. During that time, I was unable to move and in excruciating pain. I was unable to get to the phone and forced to wait the 2.5 hours until my wife got home, and I really thought she was going to find me dead. I will never forget that 2.5 hours, and I will do anything to prevent that from happening again. I was originally not convinced that cannabis could help my symptoms because I smoked cannabis recreationally when I was in my 20s till I was about 30, and I stopped because I didn't like the high. In 2010, I did my own experiment to discover if it could relieve the symptoms and to help stop the attacks. When the warning signs of an attack arrived, I would alternate between vaporizing a small amount of cannabis or going with the two medications that I wear, emergency medications that I wear around my neck. Alprazolam and quinine are the two, so Xanax and quinine. Alprazolam and quinine are effective about 70% of the time, whereas the cannabis was effective in a vaporizing 100% of the time. It was slightly less effective when I consumed it orally because of the time that it takes for it to get into my system. But it was still better and faster than alprazolam and quinine. The alprazolam and quinine I need to chew up. So I take a Xanax pill and a quinine pill and I chew them up. The Food and Drug Administration has cautioned consumers against using quinine for muscle spasms because the side effects are severe, including death. Chewing up together quinine and Xanax and quinine could kill me. Along with the high addictive nature of Xanax and the physical withdrawal symptoms, side effects actually intensify other symptoms of my disease, including the unsteadiness, slurred speech, weight gain, more muscle twitches, which make me think I'm about to have a massive attack, and sexual dysfunction. I now only use the quinine and the alprazolam when I have an attack outside of my home. When I am in my home, I will vaporize a small amount of cannabis, and the attack stops immediately 100% of the time. I'm 46 years old, and I have a lot more life to live, and I will do whatever is necessary to improve the quality of my life, and I don't want to become a criminal in the process. And I think it's important for people to understand that the way it is currently, having to buy cannabis on the street, number one, you don't know what you're getting. But the other part of this is, if I have it in my possession and I were to, like, give it to somebody else, The laws are currently minimal. If I got into this program, that same thing would be severe. The consequences would be severe, which are good because I'm basically signing a contract with the state saying, thank you for doing this. Thank you for giving me safe access. And I guarantee you I will stick with the program and not abuse the program because I know that the penalties are severe. Thank you very much for hearing my testimony. Does anyone have any questions?
Thank you, Mr. McClellan. Members, do you have any questions for the testifier? Again, thank you for coming today and sharing your experiences with us.
Thank you.
Next, I have Kim Kelsey.
Hi, my name is Kimberly Kelsey. My son, Alec, was not able to be here, so here he is. Stick him right there so you get a face with it, if you can see it. Madam Chair and members of the Senate, thank you for allowing me to share my story with you today. My name is Kim Kelsey. I live in Excelsior with my husband, Mark, our daughter, Morgan, and our son, Alec. I am here in support of medical cannabis for Alec and the thousands of Minnesotans with intractable epilepsy and patients that need it. For those of you that don't know what intractable is, it's when multiple medicines have been tried but have failed to control someone's seizures. It was the morning of Mother's Day, May 12, 1996, when we woke to find Alec, who's now 22, in his bed, unconscious, barely clinging to life. EMTs performed CPR, intubated him in our kitchen, and he was airlifted to the hospital where he spent 18 days in a coma. The doctors told us that assuming if Alec would live and wake up from the coma, he was rated at best to be in a vegetative state for the rest of his life. Well, Alec did wake from the coma and went on to defy all of the odds. He had to relearn everything from the basic things like eating, talking, walking, etc. We got him back, and that was miracle number one. The formal diagnosis was encephalitis, a high fever that caused him to have a seizure in the middle of the night, and he aspirated, leaving him deprived of oxygen for an unknown period of time. The result, bilateral brain damage, which led to what now has been an 18-year battle with life-threatening seizures. Initially, we were told it could take up to 2 years to find the right medication. And here we are, 18 years and 24 anticonvulsants later, Alec's seizures remain uncontrolled. Today, he takes a combination of 5 medications and 32 pills a day, and they don't stop the seizures that he has daily. To put this in more perspective, a leading Minnesota neurologist recently told us that for any patient that has exhausted as many meds as Alec and remains uncontrolled, the likelihood of a new anticonvulsant working for him is less than 3%. Alec's seizures are life-threatening, so my husband and I are with him 24/7. And when I say 24/7, I truly mean it. Alec is 22 years old. He is 6 feet 2 inches tall, 175-pound young man that is physically capable but cannot be left alone. My husband sleeps with him, must be in the shower with him, and he is under our supervision at all times. He has no freedoms. We carry an emergency medication called Diastat, which must be delivered rectally to stop a seizure that could take his life. Imagine me or yourself in the aisle of Target trying to administer this medication to a 6'2", 175-pound young man in a life-and-death situation. I've done it way too many times. He is also considered at high risk for SUDEP, which stands for Sudden Unexplained Death in Epilepsy. This puts him at risk of death, even when he is not seizing. We have been around the country for every conceivable test to see if he would be a surgical candidate, which he is not. That's the negative side of the story. But Alec will not allow us to look at it that way. People ask us all the time, how do you cope with it all? Our response is Alec is the one walking around not knowing when he might have a seizure. What right do we have to complain? He has shown us what it means to persevere. From the beginning, he did not only not complain, he always found a way to make the best of it, and that's what we've done as his parents, try to create a life for him. He was the winning kid at age 9 for the Epilepsy Foundation and got to throw out the first pitch at the Twins game. Still a huge highlight in his life. Alec was born an athlete and has a ferociously competitive spirit. This is how he beat the odds then and why he lives for sports today. He was able to play mainstream sports until he was 11 and then was involved in the Adapted Athletics program since 7th grade until he graduated. He participated in 4 varsity sports within the Adapted program. He lettered 19 times, was all-conference in all 4 sports, led his team to the state tournament in all sports, and won the championship in bowling. He was also awarded the Einar Anderson Athlete of the Year Award. by his entire senior class of 2010 from Minnetonka High School. Today he competes with our Special Olympics delegation that our family has started, the West Metro Warriors. We started this for him in 2007 with five athletes to ensure that he would have a competitive outlet. He is a leader in our delegation that has now grown to support more than 75 athletes and their families. Alec is a global messenger for Special Olympics. He accompanies executives to fundraising and awareness events and delivers his story in the form of a five-minute speech. This is actually my first speech I've ever given, so he was giving me pointers last night on what to do. I actually forgot to take the deep breath that he told me right before, but it's okay. One of the lines in his speech is, "I have seizures all the time, but it never stops me, and it won't stop me. I love playing sports." This is so true. When he was little, he would have a seizure on the ice during a hockey game, and my husband would carry him off the ice to the bench. The first thing out of his mouth when he regained consciousness, "Dad, don't let me miss my shift." We have done all we can, and we will continue to do all we can to never let him miss another shift. Last weekend at the Special Olympics State Basketball Tournament, Alec had a seizure in the first half of the semifinal game. I ran the length of the court as he stood stiff, about to fall to the ground, not breathing. Caught him, as we have 100% of the time. Got him to the bench, and he rested. He came back to finish the game in the fourth quarter. That's just who Alec is. The frequency and severity of his seizures don't allow him to participate in a traditional work program like his buddies. He's more than capable of contributing to society, so we started a screen printing company for him. He and his friends with intellectual disabilities worked the business. We started this in Minnesota. This is where we're from. This is where we live, and we've made a life for him, and we don't want to have to leave. Alec has definitely paid his dues and deserves to live the rest of his life seizure and side effect free. Unfortunately, we've run out of options. The years have taken a toll on his body. As conditioned he is and how important sports and being in shape is, we have had to have his liver function test be monitored constantly, and he was just in the last 3 weeks diagnosed with palindromic arthritis, which is likely drug-induced. 18 years of these meds have taken its toll. He trembles uncontrollably and suffers from neuropathy. He won't give up on himself, and we won't give up on finding a cure. Time is not on our side. To be honest, medical cannabis is the closest thing that we have had to a potential cure or miracle that we've heard or seen and read about in a very long time. It's been a very, very difficult debate to listen to. We are so sympathetic to all the people that would benefit from the legalization of medical cannabis in its most abundant form. We are fighting. We are fighting and hopeful for something very, very different for Alec. We won't be around forever. We don't know who will be there to take care of him. The oil extract with no psychoactive properties that we're searching for, you could not get high from it. It could only help. Unlike other people, we are not able to buy a safe and effective form of what we would need on the street. Instead, we would need to travel to another state and transport it across state lines to Minnesota. If caught, we would face felony drug trafficking charges, which is not a petty misdemeanor, as has been suggested before. We are not willing to do this. What we need is legal access with appropriate regulation to ensure the safety and efficacy of what we would provide for Alec. And now what we need, and we're counting on you to help us achieve miracle number two. Thank you.
Thank you very much for sharing. Are there any questions for Ms. Kelsey? Thank you again. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. I'll take Alec.
Jonathan Holmgren is the next person on the list.
Thank you.
Hello. Welcome. Please state your name for the record.
Jonathan Holmgren. Hello, I'm Jonathan Holmgren. I'm 32 years old and a disabled citizen of Springlink Park, Minnesota. For the past 4 years, I've been smoking cannabis to treat a life-threatening gastrointestinal autoimmune disease called Crohn's disease and three inflammatory diseases associated with my Crohn's disease called sacroiliitis, cervical spondylitis, and pancreatitis. I also have a genetic mutation called Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, type 2. My life almost ended prematurely because of conventional pharmaceutical drug treatments due to dangerous side effects with anti-TNF biologicals, steroids, and anti-cancer medications on myself. I'm also unable to treat pain with oral opiate-based pain medications due to my pancreatitis. Smoking cannabis protects my life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness by returning a sense of normalcy to my life, by treating my pain, nausea, and deadly inflammation from complex medical conditions. My medical cannabis use is supervised by three of the best doctors in Minnesota, my gastroenterologist, my neurologist, and my primary physician. Minnesota doctors, patients, and caregivers need options for medical treatments, not restrictions. There is not one type of cannabis to treat every medical condition. There are many types of cannabis. How one type of cannabis treats a patient will be entirely different for another patient as it is for all medications. I need the option to smoke cannabis because with Crohn's disease, even the small task of drinking a sip of water can cause a Crohn's patient to get nauseated, vomit, or worse. Time is of the essence, and there aren't minutes to pack a vaporizer, wait to eat cannabis, and a pill form is not effective due to Crohn's disease malabsorption. Smoking cannabis helps within seconds, not minutes. I also do not sell my cannabis medication because the value of my life is worth more than any dollar amount. The option to treat with cannabis is the right of any patient suffering from a debilitating or life-threatening medical condition. Because Minnesota patients and caregivers don't want to be told we're going to be okay. We don't want to be told we're going to wait and see. We just want to be free, free from our pain, free from our suffering, and free to take back control of our lives. If I didn't make the choice to medically treat with cannabis, I wouldn't be alive to share my story with you today. I wouldn't be able to volunteer in my community. I wouldn't be able to share it in the lives of my friends and family. Thomas Jefferson, a pretty cool president, once said, "If people let government decide what foods they eat and what medicines they take, their bodies will soon be in as sorry a state as are the souls of those who live under tyranny." So please remember, the cost of not legalized medical access to cannabis for ill, disabled, and dying Minnesotans is life. Thank you.
Thank you very much for sharing. Are there any questions for the testifier? Thank you again for coming. Next, I have Joni Whiting.
This is a picture of my
Can
mom.
You just make sure you speak into the microphone? It's otherwise we can't hear. And please introduce yourself first and then continue.
This was my daughter before she was diagnosed with her cancer. Oh, I apologize. My name is Joni Whiting, JoniWhiting.
Thank you.
And for my speech, these are the pictures of my daughter in the 89 days that I'm going to speak about in my testimony today. I appreciate the opportunity to be here today so I can share my family's story. More specifically, I am here to tell the story of my daughter, Stephanie, a hard worker, loving wife, and amazing mother of three. In June of 2000, at 24 years of age, Stephanie was diagnosed with melanoma skin cancer on her face that developed during her third pregnancy. The next 2 years were filled with experimental therapies and endless surgeries as they cut her face off one inch at a time until there was nothing left to cut. The pain she was experiencing was unimaginable, and a nausea so severe that it became difficult for her to eat. That was when an oncologist at the hospital pulled me aside and told me that Stephanie might benefit from using marijuana. At the time, we did not consider that as an acceptable option. I was strongly opposed to its use. I was afraid of the consequences associated with marijuana's illegal status. After Stephanie's 10th surgery, all efforts to save her life had failed, and her oncologist predicted she had about 6 months to live. As her tumors continued to grow, her whole body was racked with continuous and uncontrollable pain. No matter how much OxyContin or oxycodone she took, it provided little to no relief. Extreme nausea was resulting in dangerously rapid weight loss, and the anti-nausea medications had all failed. Marinol, a synthetic version of THC, one of the active chemicals in marijuana, was prescribed in a last-ditch effort to prolong her life. That's when these pictures were taken, too. I can tell you, it simply did not work. Marinol made her dizzy and spacey and did not increase her appetite or alleviate any of the pain or other symptoms, specifically her nausea. The side effects were too severe to continue to use it. I realized then that Stephanie was not going to die from her melanoma skin cancer. Stephanie was going to die from starvation. At that point, my other adult children began begging me to let Stephanie use marijuana in my home. She had the finest doctors and hospital available here in Minnesota. And I mistakenly believed that if an illegal drug was useful, it would already be available. I was too scared, and I didn't believe it would be beneficial, so I refused. Her older brother then took her out of my home so that she could use it. When she came home 3 days later, I felt like I was witnessing a miracle. Stephanie looked better than I had seen her in over a year. She was eating again. For the first time in months, she was eating 3 meals a day and keeping the food down. And for reasons I don't know, marijuana also seemed to enhance the effects of her pain medication without making her feel high. Just a few puffs of smoke in the bathroom with the vent on periodically throughout the day was enough to relieve her suffering and give her the strength to interact and play a little with her children, talk to the family. She sat at the table for Thanksgiving and Christmas that year. Having her there was priceless to us, but especially to her 3 small children, Alexis 9, Phoenix 8, and little Jacob 2. When that doctor first suggested Stephanie use medical marijuana, my fear of being caught and my bias to its usefulness was too significant to overcome. But once I saw how much relief it provided my suffering daughter, I was willing to risk everything, including going to jail. I would rather have spent the rest of my life in prison than deny her the medicine that helped her to live 89 more days. I don't use drugs. I don't abuse alcohol. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I'm a mother, and I'm a great-grandmother. I've raised 4 children, and I'm now raising the children my daughter had to leave behind. As a lifelong volunteer, I have dedicated a large portion of my own life to people to help them stay clean and drug-free. But I saw with my own eyes that for medical purposes, marijuana works. People say that there is no greater loss than when a parent loses their child. And they're right. I lost my mother 3 weeks after my daughter, and my husband 6 months after my mother. Neither used marijuana because they didn't need it. At this point, there is nothing that can be done for me, and nothing can be done for my daughter. But there is something that can be done for those families across Minnesota that are currently dealing with similar situations to mine. We need merely to open our eyes and see their pain, even if it isn't as obvious as in Stephanie's case. The sick and dying people of Minnesota deserve compassion, dignity, and honor, and that is what this bill and passing this law will provide. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ms. Whiting, and very sorry for your losses.
Thank you.
Are there any questions?
Madam Chair, I sense the passage of time and the desire to get to the policy discussion. So that'll be it for the proponent's testimony. And
okay.
I know a couple of folks want to come up and provide some other perspectives, so maybe we can jump to them.
Sure. Can you? I'm not sure who would that be.
I know we have Commissioner Ed Ellinger and I think Cinda Jessen.
Commissioner Ellinger, would you please?
Welcome, Commissioner, to the committee. Please introduce yourself, even though that's not necessary for the sound, and please begin with your testimony.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Ed Ellinger, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Health, and thank you for the opportunity to share my thoughts on House File 1641. Like Senator Dibble and the other authors on this bill and the people who have testified on this bill this morning, I am interested in finding a way to use the powerful chemicals within the marijuana plant to help people who are suffering. As a pediatrician who has cared for sick children and children with special health care needs, and as the primary caregiver of a spouse with chronic and debilitating condition that limits her ability to function independently, I know how difficult it can be to watch a loved one struggle with major illness, disability, or pain. I also know that we often place great hope in new treatments and medications that hold the promise of relieving this suffering. It is human nature to search for any and all options to help those who are suffering. And one of the responsibilities of the medical community is help people in those situations by providing sound information and guidance, information and guidance that has a solid scientific foundation, so patients and family members can properly weigh the benefits and risks of the treatment options available to them. To carry out this professional responsibility, the medical community must have the trust of the people. There must be confidence that the information provided about the various conditions, medicines, and treatments is backed by quality research, scientifically sound information, and reproducible results. To earn and maintain that public trust, the medical community has created a rigorous framework for reviewing and approving medications. It is a system built on hard evidence and structured to maximize the benefits and minimize the risks. Drugs are provided to individuals for clinical use only after they are subjected to rigorous protocols to assess efficacy, safety, and appropriate usage. Without those standards, we would regress to a system where elixirs are inconsistent composition, unknown interactions, and variable quality get dispensed to the public. We have worked very hard to create a high-quality and trusted healthcare system. We can't jeopardize that trust. As a physician and as the state health commissioner, my goal is to find a way to incorporate the potential medical benefits of marijuana into the time-tested, protective medical framework that has served us so well for so many years. That's why I am supportive of the goal of Senate File 1641, even as I have serious concerns about how the bill proposes to reach that goal. Let me illustrate some of those concerns by sharing some of what I've learned about the use of cannabis for one condition, intractable epilepsy. We have been told that high cannabidiol or CBD extracts, the non-psychoactive component of cannabis, have been helpful in treating children with epilepsy. We've checked on this with literature reviews, discussions with colleagues in other states, as well as with doctors treating affected children and pharmaceutical companies working on CBD trials. Here's what we've learned. There are some stories of dramatic improvement, but the beneficial impacts appear to be spotty. In one state, it appears that only about 20% of children respond positively, and significant side effects are now being recognized in many children. Where there is a beneficial impact for children taking CBD compounds, the benefits are variable over time. This is likely due to the great variability of the product's composition and quality. For example, while some CBD compounds are touted to be low in THC, the psychoactive element in cannabis, testing has shown that the compounds are quite variable in their quality and in the percentage of THC that they contain. Most troubling to me, as a pediatrician, is that recent studies suggest that THC may actually be a poor choice for people with epilepsy, and it may be a particularly poor choice for children with epilepsy. Research is demonstrating that THC negatively impacts brain development. This is a major concern because of the natural response of a child's brain when dealing with epilepsy is to rewire itself. With that in mind, there are obvious risks in introducing a substance that interferes with that natural development. That is why clinicians with knowledge in this field of study strongly recommend that medication for children include no THC. Unfortunately, removal of THC from organic materials is expensive, difficult, and a time-consuming process. Therefore, a proposal that allows cultivation and manufacture of low THC strains in our state without acknowledging this significant limitation would seem to understate the challenges of getting pure CBD medicine into the hands of patients. It is important to keep in mind that cannabis is not a single drug or a single active ingredient. It is a complex substance containing more than 400 chemicals. Its complexity presents many opportunities for unexpected interactions, and that makes it imperative for us to get as much information as we can to gauge its medicinal benefits and risks. That research, like all research on proposed medication, must consider dosage, timing, drug interactions, side effects, and other factors. We are concerned that Senate File 1641 bypasses this rigorous approach and leaves patients to self-administer powerful chemicals and, in essence, conduct their own experiments. Admittedly, much more research needs to be conducted on the appropriate use of cannabis. Fortunately, numerous trials are now underway. We know of at least 171 open clinical trials that are using cannabis. And those trials focus on the use of cannabis in many of the conditions that are outlined in this legislation. Clinical trials are the ideal way to ensure rapid and safe access to promising medicines. Despite its good intentions, Senate File 1641 creates a risky shortcut for a substance of variable quality and strength, putting doctors in a very tough spot. Knowing the significant variations in potency and quality, how would they advise their patients on how to use cannabis? What's the recommended dosage? What are the side effects or potentially worrisome interactions with other medications they may be taking? What's even more troubling to me is that this legislation bypasses a significant part of the doctor-patient relationship. All it requires is that a licensed clinician certify that a patient may benefit from the use of medical marijuana. The patient is then left alone to choose a marijuana product formulated and dispensed by an unlicensed person with no requirement of a medical or pharmaceutical background. We don't allow this for any other medication. 21st century physicians don't want to practice 19th century medicine, specifically when we are dealing with some of the sickest and most vulnerable members of our community. We want them cared for by a medical provider in a high-quality and evidence-based therapeutic relationship. Now, beyond the healthcare viewpoint that medical cannabis should be considered within the same rigorous scientific and medical framework as other medicines, we also have a number of administrative concerns about Senate File 1641. I won't go into detail, but just let me highlight a few. Would medical marijuana smoke be regulated under Minnesota Clean Indoor Air Act? What would be the extent of the Minnesota Department of Health's regulatory authority over alternative treatment centers, medical marijuana organizations, practitioners, and safety compliance facilities, whatever those may be? What would our general regulatory powers apply to these entities? For example, would we be able to conduct unannounced inspections? The language does not authorize receiving and investigating complaints made against alternative treatment centers, safety compliance facilities, and cardholders. Where would such complaints go, and who would investigate them? We assume that the Board of Medical Practice would retain jurisdiction to conduct investigations of physicians wrongly approved of using medical cannabis by a patient, but that authority should be specified somewhere. And in addition to the administrative and regulatory issues, we have logistical concerns. We've heard from many patients that they want access in Minnesota to the current cannabis compound that they're using in another state. We're not sure how the bill would accomplish that goal. For example, we are not aware if importation would occur or be allowed under this bill or under federal law. Alternatively, if the goal is to create similar medicines by cultivating and processing our own product, we have questions about the feasibility of replicating compounds from other states by raising plants under Minnesota growing conditions. Like other plants, the way marijuana is grown affects its property, soil, the amount of sun, fertilizers, and the seeds used all affect the amount of THC, CBD, and other compounds in the plant. When you factor in the manufacturing process to create ingestible medicine, we could expect to see significant variability in the product's medicinal properties. In our discussions with a licensed pharmaceutical manufacturer, we learned how difficult and expensive it is to create quality products with the required consistency and uniformity from a marijuana plant. We are unsure how Senate File 1641 would address this issue. Given these unresolved questions and the need to protect public confidence in the review process for medications, our view is that legalization of cannabis for medical use should be undertaken with deliberation and caution. In my talks with colleagues from other states where medical marijuana has become legal, they told me we should proceed with caution and expect the unexpected. Many of them also recommend that we wait to learn information from their experiences. As Governor Hickenlooper from Colorado recently said, "I don't tell other governors what to do, but when they asked me, I said, if I was in your shoes, I would wait a couple of years and see whether there are unintended consequences from what is admittedly well-intentioned law." To me, that's good advice. So as a physician and as a state's health commissioner, I ask you to reject Senate File 1641, but continue to work with the medical and research community to look for scientifically sound ways to discover the benefits of medical marijuana. We share the goal of Senate File 1641 in that we want to give physicians and families safe and effective treatment options. That goal is advanced, not hindered, by evaluating medical marijuana with the same scientific rigor applied to other potential medicines. Marijuana should be tested for effectiveness, safety, and interactions with other medications. By following this process, doctors around the state will be able to have full confidence when prescribing it to patients and instructing them on how to use it. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Commissioner. Are you willing to take some questions at this time?
Yes, I am.
Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, thank you. Commissioner, I want to ask you a couple questions. As a doctor, not as a health commissioner, and I understand you play both roles. But when we had Dr. Meerman testify earlier today, he talked about he has a legal prohibition on recommending medical marijuana, and he feels he has an ethical responsibility to tell patients what he thinks may work for them, may be in their best interest. You're a physician. How do you understand his dilemma there?
Commissioner.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty. Yes, as a physician, I, in working with patients, I want to give them the best care possible, and I want to be evidence-based. So I tell patients what I know, what the science has said, what research has indicated, and what the benefits and risks are. With medical marijuana, we cannot make those kinds of statements. We don't know, because of the variability in the plant, we don't know what they will be getting, what kind of benefit they would accrue, what the risks would be. So that it's a difficult situation for a provider to be in. There are lots of anecdotal evidences, but the scientific evidence is not there to support recommending medical marijuana for a patient.
Madam Chair, Commissioner.
Senator Marty.
I agree about the need for more research. He did point out the catch-22 when it's a Schedule I drug. How do you conduct the research? And if we don't have the research, how do you get it off Schedule I? How do you treat it that way? But I guess when I hear the testimony, and I think you were here for all the testimony, when you hear Mr. McClellan talk about his example, excruciating pain, being trapped, I mean, every one of the stories, painful stories, and in some of the cases, they've been using this in a situation that they believe has made their life significantly better. And I understand that that's not laboratory, double-blind tests. It's not everything you'd like to do in medical research. But if you're his doctor, and I don't want to put you in an unfair spot because you're not his doctor, but Dr. Meerman seemed to be and have patients in situations like that, And the idea that we wait a couple years or so for more research, I think the one thing I think the medical community has learned in the last 30 or 40 years is how much they don't know. And, I mean, I remember in the 70s when, what's his name, the editor of the Saturday Evening Review or whatever, Norman Cousins, when he got hired by UCLA medical faculty, the first non-physician there because of new modes of practice in ancient Chinese medicine and so on that are now accepted, medical community. These are medical doctors who are also practicing in acupuncture and other things. And when we don't know this, and again, you're not in Dr. Meerman's shoes or something, but I just wonder how the idea that we're going to wait a couple years to get more research when these are doctors treating patients. They are licensed doctors who, as far as I know, are very fine professionals, and they're seeing this situation. I struggle with how. I understand you'd like to have perfect evidence of that, but you have patients who die. I mean, you have patients who aren't making it. You have young kids who are struggling, and I'm not sure saying that, well, we can wait a couple years till we get better evidence. I don't know. I've never smoked a cigarette, so I forget marijuana. I've never smoked any of that. But when I hear them say what I have heard from so many other sources, and I believe to be true, that in terms of addictive power, certainly the opiates, things that are prescribed, I've had prescriptions for them after surgery. When you have those sorts of things and all these other things that are legal, sometimes for medical purposes or with alcohol and tobacco, just legal across the board, I'm just wondering whether balancing is, should be we doing research and saying in these very limited cases we try and do it. And I understand, I mean, I didn't get into any of your concerns as commissioner about the implementation, but just wanted to ask, how would you deal with that if you were those doctors?
Commissioner Ellinger.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, you raise lots of interesting issues. And by the fact that marijuana is illegal makes it somewhat more difficult, because there are times when physicians in dealing with a patient, you've tried lots of things, and there are alternatives that are there out in the community with no evidence. And on an individual basis, the clinician making his or her clinical decision says some alternative therapy might be worth trial and can recommend that or suggest that, but as long as it's legal. Having marijuana as being an illegal drug makes that somewhat more difficult. However, when we're making public policy about things, we have to look not just at what happens on an individual case, but really what's the overall cost and benefit. And particularly when we're dealing with medications, there have been many examples where a drug may be beneficial to an individual, but be tremendously harmful to the population as a whole. There have been many drugs that have been purported to have benefits, and that have been really shown when the research has been done that they are really negative. So to make something available widely to act as part of public policy, we have to say what is the greatest good for, and looking at the risks and benefits for the entire population that will be potentially using it. And particularly with a drug like marijuana, where the components, some of the components have some significant impacts on the developing brain. They have significant impacts on addiction. They have, others, and we cannot guarantee the quality and the consistency of the product. That makes it very difficult to say this should be available for everyone.
And Senator Marty?
Madam Chair, that's why I'm glad Senator Dibble's bill doesn't go that direction, say it's available for everyone. They're saying we want to make sure that people who are in these situations, very limited ones in this very limited protocol, we're not in an ideal world where we're going to know all the evidence. And I guess if I were Dr. Meerman, I would, in recommending to my patients, I think I'd be using code words, which is I'm sure what the doctors are doing, saying, hey, we've heard stories about this, and here's some evidence that we've seen, and I don't know how to tell you. I mean, I don't know how you deal with this issue, but here's what others are saying, and as a doctor, I mean, it seems to me when you're trying to do the best for your patient, you may be in that spot, which is why, if not this, I guess saying rather than wait 2 years, I guess they do have, or 3 or 4 or 6 or 10 years, in which case some of these kids, they can't wait that way. And I guess I wonder if there's some other alternative you'd propose where doctors at least not have get penalized for using their best judgment here, or patients have some sort of out in court or something else. I'm just asking that. I'll end with that because I didn't want to. You're Commissioner of Health. You have two roles here, but you mentioned as a doctor, and I just am trying to figure out because I don't think this is a tenable situation to tell doctors you can't talk about this and tell patients you can't use this. And we've heard several families who say they will leave the state. And I don't think anybody who's opposed to this is saying that's a good option. I don't think strongest opponents of this bill would say, oh, we don't care about them. I think they'd say that pains us. But I'm asking if there's any other alternative you see other than, say, let's study for several years.
Would you like to respond to that, yeah, Senator?
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, there are lots of unanswered questions with marijuana, and there are lots of risks and some potential benefits that are there. As health commissioner, as a physician, if this is going to be part of the medical armamentarium, I would want to make sure that we have quality products, consistent products that have been researched and studied so that they can be part of the medical armamentarium to deal with disease. As opposed to a natural food that may or may not have some benefits and may be quite variable. I believe that this is important enough that we do need to do some research, and lots of research is being done. We need to look at the components of particularly the CBD and its impact, and there are companies and researchers that are looking at this. It may not be moving as fast as some people would like, but that is the approach that we take in our society, in our medical care system, when there is a new medication being proposed, that it go through the procedures, because it's there to protect the safety and benefit of everybody in our society.
Thank you, Commissioner. Senator Benson, and Senator Rosen, and then Senator.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And to Commissioner Ellinger, I'm asking you to put on your doctor hat. I don't know the answer to this. If a doctor uses a prescription drug for something that's off-label, what happens to them?
Commissioner Ellinger.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, as long as it's an FDA-approved drug and the physician can and prescribes it, it can be used for other activities, other treatments, and there's no penalties for that.
And Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, I guess my path then is we allow doctors to use their medical judgment for some things, and so I'd like us to consider the ability of doctors to use their medical judgment for this as well. And I think that's where a lot of people in the room would like to be, that we trust doctors to use their medical judgment on FDA-approved drugs for off-label uses. I understand dosing issues and all of those kinds of things need to be dealt with, but I think we can narrow the conversation a little bit to professional judgment when it comes to doctors' use.
Thank you, Senator Benson. Did you want to respond to that, or we can go to another question? Commissioner?
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, the one difference is when a physician uses a drug, it is an FDA-approved drug that has been studied, and so that the side effects are known, the drug interactions are known, so that the physician is using it with a lot more information at his or her disposal than with marijuana, which has not been FDA-approved, has not had, we don't know all of the interactions, and it is quite variable in quality.
If I may follow up, Senator Benson.
Madam Chair, and to that point, but if they're using it for an off-label purpose, it's something for which the FDA has not tested, I guess, is that it's called off-label for a reason. And so I want to be careful that we don't make the FDA some sort of sacred entity that is perfect in all of its judgment, and that we allow it to kind of think. We already allow doctors to go outside the bounds of the FDA, so I would ask us to cautiously approach that that we let doctors use some professional judgment outside the FDA on other issues as well.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, that's unfortunately, Commissioner, you are wearing the two hats here. And unfortunately, the comments that have been directed to you have been on your professional or your PhD side and not as a commissioner. And I thought your testimony was compelling. I don't know if I can listen to it again, but if you could share those notes, I certainly would approve it. Appreciate some of your comments on that. And as you said, marijuana is a Schedule I drug, and it's under the Federal Controlled Substance Act. I think that's something that is first and foremost that we have to remember. This is a Schedule I drug. And so I think until we have the law enforcement, until we have the treatment community, and we have adolescent psychologists come to the table and say, yes, we should be able to do this under a controlled manner, this seems like your comments are very appropriate, Commissioner. And I just looking through, there's so much information about this, and all I know is the information that's coming from the treatment community that more kids are smoking marijuana than they smoke cigarettes right now. Kids are at 12th graders are using alcohol at 68%, marijuana at 45% now. It's increased. More kids are smoking marijuana than cigarettes, and I find that really troubling. Being from born and raised in Colorado, I can attest to the comments from the governor. There are some severe issues, and if you want to get your hands around the issue of kids smoking, and you've got legalized marijuana in your backyard, there are a whole set of issues that we could continue on. And I see Commissioner Jessen is right behind you too. And perhaps I don't know if she wants to.
Yeah, Senator Resnick, thank you.
But I do have an amendment at some point. And
okay.
We
have time. We do not have time here to complete this process. So let me just be clear that Commissioner Jessen is here. I would like to. I know that there are others who have asked to ask questions of Dr. Ellinger, and I hope that you will stay. But I want to give Commissioner Jessen a chance to make her comments here. Then, if we have time for some questions. For either of them or for Senator Dibble, we can begin that process, but we will need to adjourn for session. And because it's clear that I've been informed that a number of people have a lot of questions to ask on the bill, and so I've discussed this through notes with Senator Dibble. I'm an expert at note sending from grade school. Senator Dibble is recommending that we do is that we take as many questions as we possibly can before session. Then I think that it is in our best interest, because people will not be comfortable yet to take action, that we lay the bill on the table at that time and come back after break and continue this conversation. Well, but if we get all our testimony in, then we can have our conversation afterwards.
Madam Chair. Yeah, I just wanted to affirm that I think is important. You know, I've been working on this issue a long time. It's an important issue. A lot of people care about it from all sides and all perspectives. It's my interest that we give full airing to all the issues and concerns, bring them to light, and duly consider them. I'm not at all interested in rushing this through this process. I think it's important.
So with that, welcome, Commissioner. Please introduce yourself and begin your comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'm Lucinda Jessen, Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Human Services. As I think all of you know, DHS is the substance abuse authority for our state government. And so I'm speaking to you, and my comments will be brief in that role. You know, I have great sympathy for the people who've testified here this morning, but I must say I also have great concerns about increasing the availability of marijuana in our state. I just want to give you a few reasons from my perspective, the substance abuse perspective, why that is. I mean, marijuana is addictive. I mean, I just want to kind of put that on the table. And in 2012, over half of the people who went into CD treatment in our state reported using marijuana in the 30 days before. 17% said it was their substance abuse of choice. And I'm particularly concerned about really two populations. And I raise this because I do think that I urge caution as we proceed because of these two populations. First, I'm very concerned about those who begin to use marijuana in their adolescence. And I'll say a little bit more about that. And second, I'm very concerned about those who are either at risk of developing a mental illness or for people who are already living with a mental illness. Let me talk first about our youth. As Dr. Ellinger said earlier, there is a lot of research that says marijuana use has impact on developing brains. And so there's been a number of a recent study who said that children, youth, who begin in adolescence have substantially reduced connectivity between brain areas that are responsible for learning and memory, affects their ability to do complicated things, to participate in athletics, and that heavy use means that impact can be can continue for a long time and may be permanent. And I think this is particularly important because while only 9% of people who use marijuana overall become dependent, addicted, that's 1 in 6 for people who start, for those people who start in their adolescence. So I'm concerned about our adolescents. But I'm also concerned, as I said, about those who are at risk of developing mental illness or people who are living with it. The National Institute on Drug Abuse marijuana research showed that regular marijuana use contributes to and exacerbates mental health issues in individuals, and that marijuana users who consume larger doses may experience acute psychoses. And there are a number of studies, Madam Chair, members, that link chronic marijuana use and mental illness. Now, I'll be the first to say that those studies also leave a lot of unanswered questions. There's much to confirm and to better understand those linkages, but I think it is another reason that I would urge great caution as you proceed, caution about expanding the availability of marijuana in our state.
Thank you, Commissioner. Is there anyone else wishing to testify that's come here to testify today? Yes, there is one more person who wishes to testify. Please let us know your name and what and whom you represent, and I just would hope that it's not repetitious communication from other testifiers to make your essential points, because we're running up on time for the committee hearing.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. My name is Oliver Steinberg. My residence is St. Paul, and I'm appearing here as a citizen who's witnessed the legislature's work on this issue since 1991. I'm also fortunate to be a survivor of cancer. Now, I will abbreviate my testimony.
Thank you.
And I'll just ask this. Why is the legislature getting sidetracked into trying to practice medicine and settle scientific disputes? I respectfully ask, is that your task? I think your responsibility is to uphold our Constitution, which says explicitly, every Minnesotan is entitled to a certain remedy in law for all injuries or wrongs, and to obtain justice completely and without denial. So let's look at the obvious. The patients who've testified for 23 years before your committees, and the desperate parents and the bereaved family members, it's plain as day that they have no criminal intent. They didn't ask to be sick. In the situation, not of their own making, they might even break the law, but only to avoid a greater harm of imminent danger to their health, safety, and well-being, or their loved ones' health, safety, and well-being. Logically, this is no different from other cases of self-defense, where inescapable circumstances justify actions which would ordinarily be illegal. But logic aside, legally, it is different. No one has mentioned what Minnesota law is. Under the 1991 decision in State versus Hansen, the court ruled that a patient who's had the misfortune to be arrested has no legal right to present a defense of necessity. A patient can't go into court and defend himself, can't explain his motives for the deed, isn't permitted to introduce a doctor's testimony of therapeutic need. That's Minnesota law. It is harsh. Abraham Lincoln once said, "Nothing should ever be implied as law which leads to unjust or absurd consequences." Patients using cannabis under doctors' care are not a threat to public safety. And I don't think law enforcement opponents of the bill really want to arrest the more sympathetic or simply the more pathetic patients. This bill gives them a statutory reason, in some cases at least, not to arrest or prosecute, which would be in law enforcement's own best interests in order to distinguish the discretion they use from discrimination. This is a very restrictive bill. It excludes many patients. It actually perpetuates the compulsory criminalization of large numbers of patients, denying equal protection of the law. But nevertheless, it would be better than our existing law, because the ironic truth of the matter is law-abiding, law-respecting citizens are the only people actually deterred from using cannabis, even when their doctors realize it might provide real medical benefit and relief of suffering. They're morally upright citizens forced to choose between breaking the law, going without needed medicine, or moving to another, more enlightened state. This bill restores a shield against injustice, a remedy in law for at least some of these victims of an unjust and absurd dilemma inflicted on them by the federal legal fiction of placing cannabis in Schedule 1 of the Controlled Substances Act. In 1988, the DEA's own administrative law judge ruled, after 2 years of studying the issue, cannabis should have been rescheduled, and the bureaucrats who run that agency refused to do it. Dr. Sanjay Gupta recently said, "Marijuana is defined as one of the most dangerous drugs with no currently accepted medical use." Neither, he said, neither of those statements has ever been factual until the federal government gets its act together. Some state law must be provided to give our people a remedy in law for the wrongs and injuries they suffer. Thank you very much, Senators, and please do the right thing.
Thank you for your testimony. That concludes, I think, the people that were on our list that wanted to testify. Ma'am. So, Senator Marty,
Madam Chair, just a question. If somebody from DHS who deals with addiction stuff, if they're going to be here later, would be helpful, I think. I had one or two questions.
I have questions.
Mr. Hartford is here. He could come, and I think would you be an appropriate person to – well, what would you want to answer the question? We have – let me just hold a minute.
We're not under call.
I think we can continue to go until we're under call. So, you know, I want to make sure that I take the order of the requests for questions – Senator Marty, so unless it was for the last testifier, I'd like to continue. Senator Rosen was up with her questions. This is a time for questions. I would like to have you interface with the commissioners if you would like to, because now's the opportunity, or others who have facts, or with the author of the bill. We can debate the bill a little later, but now if you have questions for the contents or clarifications of what's in front of us, this would be the time to ask those questions. Senator Rosen.
I was just wondering if both commissioners were going to be available in the afternoon, too, or just...
We are not going to be coming back today, because once we recess from the floor, we're on break.
We're free.
So what the author has recommended that we do, and I support, is that we will table and come back after the break. So we're going to use the rest of our time now to simply gather information and ask questions. After the Easter break, yeah, I'm sorry,
Madam
not
Chair,
after the
I was
session.
Confused by that.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm sorry.
Madam Chair?
I bet you thought you were going to be here all night. No, I mean after the Easter break.
Madam Chair, I'm wondering, yes, though, if session is brief, and I don't know, I saw we have the tax bill up, but I don't know, it didn't take that long in tax committee. If we were to go to 5 o'clock or 4:30 or something, no?
Apparently, we've reviewed this, and we cannot come back once we recess from the session. Or adjourn, once they adjourn, until after the holiday break. So that's why we're going to lay it on the table and bring it back to us after the holiday break. But we can continue to use time until we get under call. And Senator Rosen, did you have a question of the author or any of the testifiers this time?
Madam Chair, I do, but I think if there's somebody that has a question for the commissioners, I guess I would defer.
Well, I have Senator Eaton's name on the list, and Senator, I guess Senator Nelson is not here, but she's also on the list. So, Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question, I don't know which commissioner would answer it, but I have friends and family who live in Colorado and California, and I don't know how many people have smelled marijuana, but it pretty much smells like you have a civet cat or a skunk in the building, and there's been several different rulings, and I'm wondering what they thought in Minnesota would win, the Clean Indoor Air Act or the Americans with Disability Act, because the Americans with Disability Act is winning in California, and so people are having to move out of apartment complexes where it's triggering asthma and they find the odor offensive.
Commissioner Ellinger, and then Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, Senator Eaton, that is sort of some of the questions that we have with the regulations that we would need to be putting forward with this legislation. Does the Clean Indoor Air Act, how does it relate to the Clean Indoor Air Act, and how does it relate to the ADA? And those are unanswered questions at this point in time.
Senator Dibble, you look like you were wanting to address that question.
Madam Chair. Draw your attention to Section 3, which provides for limitations where cannabis can be used. That's on page, bottom of page 3, Section 3. Madam Chair, that's the reason that we have the deliberative committee making process, so that we can surface. As a matter of fact, I think Commissioner Ellinger raised a couple of good concerns about the bill that I'd love to be able to speak with him about in his earlier testimony. The intention is not to expose people to smoke that they don't want to be exposed to.
Thank you. Any further questions, Senator Eaton?
Just that I don't see any protection or discussion on that in the bill that would address that concern. But I guess the other question would be,
Thank you, Senator Eaton. I think if I understood what you were saying, Senator Dibble, that under the limitations in any public place is identified as a limitation on where smoking of this product can occur. But I think if I understood the commissioner, even if this language is in the bill, there'll be a question about whether the American Disabilities Act trumps this language. Is that what we need to investigate further?
Madam Chair, my concern was apartment complexes, not public facilities. And I don't see that addressed. That's the concern that's been brought to my attention from other states that have this.
Okay. Want to say anything further?
Ms. Ozzie has a response as well.
Madam Chair, yes. Members, my name is Heather Ozzie. I'm with Minnesotans for Compassionate Care. The bill does contain some language that addresses this point, Senator Eaton. It's in the discrimination section where it provides that a landlord cannot discriminate against a patient solely for their status as a patient, but they certainly can prohibit smoking within the buildings. There's no limitation on that whatsoever.
I still have an order here. I'm sorry, Senator Marty. I'd like to go to Senator. Oh, you wanted to comment on this subject? Okay,
Madam,
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Eaton is one who was in college in years before the Indoor Clean Air Act. I remember smelling plenty of marijuana and tobacco, and I think your concern is legitimate, and I think it ought to be addressed in the bill.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize. I had to step out there for a bit, but I just had one quick procedural question and then a question for the commissioner. On the procedural question, I was just wondering about the status of this particular bill. Has it met deadlines? I was just trying to look up here and see what – or has it been to rules? What's the real procedural path of this bill here?
Thank you. This is the first hearing of this bill. Senator Dibble, this is your first hearing, correct?
Correct.
Our path today will be to lay it on the table and to bring it up after the holiday break again to this committee. We won't be taking action today. If it moves out of this committee, its next stop, I understand, is state and local government. Is that correct? But I think it has to go to rules as well in order to address some of the issues that you have about being outside of the deadline period.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. That's what I thought. I thought things had to go to rules first if they haven't met deadlines. So we're making an exception here.
Madam Chair.
Senator
Madam
Marty.
Chair. Madam Chair, no, if this committee acts, rules committee will catch the bill before it goes to state and local, and they will decide is it appropriate to move to state and local.
Thank
so
you.
It's not outside the rules. It's the way the rules will stop it after the bill passes out here.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Senator Marty, for clarifying that. I really appreciate that. My question for the commissioner, maybe something to think about since we're going to be coming back after break, and I have a lot of questions about this. I've given it a lot of thought and have done a significant amount of reading. The thing I'm going to want to know when we come back from session is particularly about the classification of marijuana now, and how that limits what can be done in regards to studying it, which, I mean, obviously, if we were ever going to use this as any medicinal purpose, there needs to be that consistent dose, and you know exactly what the active ingredients are and what an effective dose is, and it's got to be measurable and in a consistent form. And it appears to me, at least from what I can tell so far, the reason we don't have that critical information for any prescription of any kind of medicine is that it's we're being hampered by the feds. And because of how the feds have this drug categorized, we cannot actually get to that important pharmacological data that one needs to have any use of actually prescribing medicine and knowing what its effects and benefits are and how it might interact with other drugs or how it might be effective with cases in the future. And so I'd like to know, if it's simple today, you can tell me today, otherwise when we come back, really, how do we go, what's the best way to remove that barrier? That seems to be the real crux of the issue here.
Commissioner Ellinger.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, we have been in order, since it is a Schedule I drug, we would need to work with the Department, the Drug Enforcement Agency, and the National Institute of Drug Abuse, which we have been in contact with, and we have been actually working with them on finding ways to get researchers to get the appropriate approvals to do the research on Schedule I drugs. They will have to be as part of the formula, as part of the process, but they certainly have expressed a willingness to do that if we would come up with any kind of research proposal that that would go through an institutional review board and, you know, the way normal research is done, and then they would provide the authority for us to do that.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Commissioner. So has this been done in any other states where this waiver or this ability to actually research what are the active or effective ingredients, has this been done in any other states? And also, how long do you think it would take to get those approvals so the actual kind of research that is needed here could take place?
Thank you, Senator Nelson. I'm going to have you answer as best you can that question, but I want to inform the committee that we're now under call. So after your answer, we will recess.
Madam Chair, I'd like to make a closing statement.
Okay, Senator Dibble will make a closing statement. Thank you. Commissioner Ellinger.
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, we know that there are currently at least 171 clinical trials going on already in multiple states, and we know that we would, in Minnesota, we could probably get a research project going within about 6 months, which actually would be quicker than what this bill would do, because this bill would not actually allow the growing of plants for a year, and then there would be a whole process of that. We believe that with the research, with the work that we've done, that we could probably get something going within 6 months.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner. For your closing statement, Senator Dibble.
Well, first, Madam Chair, there is no way Commissioner Ellinger can know that this could happen in 6 months. The barriers are substantial. So, you know, we can make those statements, but there's absolutely no way anyone can know that. But I just wanted, I don't want to make some big closing statement. I just want to leave folks with a couple of thoughts and make sure that you pay attention to the handouts that are in your packets. I frankly share many of the concerns that were articulated by the commissioners around use and access, use by teenagers, access in the general public, et cetera, et cetera. I think if you look to the bill, the goal of the bill is to address those concerns in terms of making sure that there's very, very tight circumstances where who gets this and under what circumstances, how they get it, et cetera. A lot of provisions to make sure that the commissioner, the regulating authorities are in full control, as I presented from the outset. And then just the final thought is, of course, this isn't perfect. We know that because of the limitations on research, because of the nature of how this particular substance is viewed in federal law and the like. But I would just leave you with the thought that what is the alternative? What is the alternative for the folks that we've heard from today? I don't know that they'll necessarily be back to provide that kind of testimony, but the alternatives are few, dim, and sometimes in some circumstances worse. We can work with this with some of the details and some of the issues around the fact that the substance is imperfect. We have some provisions for dealing with the levels of purities and that sort of thing. We can go through the bill in more detail. But we can also talk about informed choice, patient-provider relationships, making people aware of their choices and their options if they do decide to pursue this path for themselves when they have very little else available to them. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Well, thank you very much, Senator Dibble. With no further discussion, Senator Marty, would you mind moving that Senate file number 1641 be laid on the table, and we will adjourn.
Okay,
until after the holiday break. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed say nay. That passes and we adjourn.
Thank you, Madam Chair.